Did you know that 1 in 2 students in the Netherlands experiences stress related to study progress? This means that either you or me could be suffering from the fear of failure. My name is Julian, and you're listening to Epic Fail, the Faculty of Arts podcast where we discuss all things failure. Whether it's about study, work, or life in general, we seem to focus primarily on success. We prefer to share our achievements rather than our failures, both offline and online. And talking about failure has an air of taboo around it, especially in a highly competitive field such as academia. But what is actually so interesting about success? Aren't failures much more interesting to share? Isn't there much more to learn from failures than from success? Today, we're joined by Hedwig Sekeres. Hedwig is a PhD candidate at the University of Groningen investigating sound changes in Gronings from a socio-dialectological perspective. Hedwig is also one of the new faces of science, which is a network of PhD candidates in the Netherlands who are involved in science communication. So, Hedwig, could you tell us a bit more about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Hedwig Sekeres. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Groningen, at the Faculty of Arts, and I look into sound change in the local dialect of Gronings.
Okay, and that's a pretty interesting study because, well, Gronings is not even spoken by every person that is a Groninger, right? So why do you think it's important to study Gronings and how the sounds change?
So Gronings is not, you're right, it's not spoken by everyone in Groningen. And in fact, it's spoken by a declining amount of people. But for the people who do speak Gronings, it is very important usually because it's very much like a part of your local regional identity. I think it's important to study these sound changes because I want to know what's going on with the language currently because it's undergoing so much change. And with that, I don't just mean from the fact that there's fewer speakers, but also from the influence of Dutch or from the influence of the different sub-dialects kind of growing closer together. So I think it's still, even though there's not many speakers or not everyone, I think it's a very relevant area of study.
Mm-hmm. And how do you conduct your studies? What is the main methods, let's say, you use?
I use different methods. So I have one study that is a bit more quantitative, where I look at, I really measure how the sounds are changing. So I have people pronounce different words, different sentences in different contexts. And I use special software to see how the sounds change. I also have a study that's a bit more attitudinal, where I ask other people to listen to the clips that we have recorded, and to have them judge like, oh, this is a modern speaker, or this is old-fashioned, or this is someone from this region or from that region. And then also still a more qualitative study where I will look into kind of the daily practices around speaking Gronings in the context of theater rehearsals.
Okay, that sounds quite interesting. And let's say when you use the software, do you just have to look at it, or does the software kind of help you with it?
Yeah, so the software kind of, it both visualizes the sound. So we use, Praat, it's called, which is a nice name, I guess, for software that analyzes audio. And it can give you numbers that you can kind of throw into models then to see how much something has changed. So you can really put a number on how different or is from R, for example.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's probably useful to non-native speakers. I had a few Dutch courses and they tried to explain differences between sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And every time the entire classroom laughed because it sounds kind of the same or almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that all of this is pretty challenging to do. I mean, you're a PhD candidate, but you've had a long way to get there, I assume. So I was actually wondering, what kind of challenges do you face in your field of work and with these studies that you conduct?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess there's many, many different kinds of challenges. So for me personally, I find it quite challenging that for the first study, which is something I'm still working on now, I have to also do some programming and some more technical things, which I'm not very naturally good at.
Okay.
So I usually like doing things that I'm naturally good at, or that I kind of inherently find interesting. But for one of the sub-studies, I had to do all these calculations with matrices and use like statistical software, and I'm a bit familiar with it, but it doesn't come natural to me, and I find that quite hard because I really have to, I don't know, drag myself through that sometimes. But it's part of the research. And sometimes it can be challenging to find participants. And especially with a study like this, where it's not always immediately clear to people why should they participate? Why is this interesting? Does it do anything for them personally? And also I often need people to be from a specific place of a specific age range. And then sometimes it's really hard to find younger speakers, especially who want to participate and who think their Gronings is good enough to participate as well.
So from everything that you mentioned, I noticed there's a general tendency for people to do things that they're more comfortable with and that maybe they feel naturally good at. Maybe for researchers like you, you would not be so comfortable with venturing into the coding aspect. And also for research participants, they might speak Gronings, but they might feel like they're not worthy to participate in the study because they're not as good as an elderly Gronings speaker. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's partly insecurity, and then especially also with the participants, sometimes you hear people say, well, I don't really speak Gronings. Like I can, in Dutch we say plat praten. So I can speak roughly, which is sometimes how people refer to the dialect, as like a rough language. And then their Gronings is perfectly fine, or it's at least something that I'm very interested in, because languages change and I'm very interested in how younger people speak, but they themselves sometimes see it as not real Gronings, and therefore I'm not going to participate in the study because like someone from the university is going to judge my language and they're going to maybe think it's not good enough. So I think it's some sort of insecurity or not feeling comfortable. And for me personally with the programming, it's definitely something where I feel I'm not good at it, and maybe I'm going to write some code and it's going to look awful, and it's going to, I hope nobody else sees it, because then it works, but it's very inelegant and kind of put together in a weird way. Yeah,
no, 100%. I think that's a ever old debate or a topic in the coding community, that there's a lot of code that works. There's also a lot of issues, for example, when code is passed on and then the new people are like, okay, like who wrote this because it's horrible?
Yeah.
So I get it. But so you say the code works, right? So then why do you have that fear? Is it maybe fearing that the code would fail, especially if, or somebody else would see it as a failure to write good code, even though it works? Like what is your, for example, definition of a failure, personal or maybe professional? Because as you said, some things work, some things are good enough, but then still people would go and say, well, I don't think that's actually good at all, right?
Yeah. In terms of coding, I mean, I do ascribe to kind of the philosophy of, if it works, then that's good enough.
Don't fix it,
if it accomplishes the goal that it was made for, then that's good. So I guess I wouldn't see that code as like a failure, but I do think it's something where, because I'm very much in support of like sharing all of your resources. Like if you made something that works, put it online and someone else can also use it.
Open source.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And open science, open data, things like that. But with that type of code, I think I wouldn't do it, because I would feel a bit judged if someone would use it. And even though it would work, and even though I would give a disclaimer like, hey, I know this code isn't like the most beautiful thing out there. I wouldn't say the code itself is a failure, but I think I would sort of be scared of it being perceived as a failure, maybe.
Maybe as a failure to know how to write beautiful code. I guess that's a thing with writing a beautiful code, even though it works, right?
Yeah.
There's so, like Snapchat is a good example. Actually, the fact that the messages disappear was never planned.
Really?
Yeah, as far as I know, it was just a mistake because somebody didn't know how to write it. So that failure actually turned into what Snapchat is today, because people use it for the fact that messages or photos disappear. I think you can save them in the chat, but the default was and still is that the messages just go, right?
I didn't know that. That's really interesting. Yeah, I think for me it mostly relates to, like, failure is mostly a failure to meet certain expectations, I guess. So maybe, yeah, if people for Snapchat were like, oh, well, I guess it's supposed to be this way, then nobody failed to meet any expectation.
Yeah.
And I think if I would, yeah, like going to the coding example, if I would put my code online, then I think people would expect that code to be worthy of something.
Of being online,
yeah.
I guess.
Like, oh, you think your code is good. That's why you put it online.
Okay.
And then I think for me, the aspect that would make it a failure or not would be whether I think I am failing to meet someone's expectations. And then those expectations are, of course, also in my own mind, where I think people have the expectation that the code is good. But I think that would be what failure is to me. So yeah, not meeting the expectations, either your own or someone else's, or the expectations that you think someone else will have.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because you also, I mean, I guess you can always kind of conceive what the expectation might be. For example, in writing a PhD, how is it called, paper, or just writing your PhD thesis?
Yeah, dissertation.
Yeah. Dissertation, papers, dissertation, yeah, okay. I mean, there are guidelines about what is expected, so I think then it's pretty clear. If you fail to meet expectations, they say how many points are going to be taken out, for example. At least a bachelor paper that I do. But then, as you said, it's pretty interesting, because sometimes we're afraid of the expectations of others, but we don't even know what these expectations are. And for example, you said with your code is you think that other people would think that if you put it online, then it's good.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe actually a lot of people have the same ideas that you have, that even if it's not great, the fact that it exists is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And you should share it, because then somebody else, like you maybe, who's not that great into it, great at it, can see it and say, oh, look, this is how she did it. I can improve on this and this and that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's always one of those things where people are like, well, if you would turn the roles around, if you would be in that position, what would you say? And I think if I was looking for code to do something and I found someone's not so beautiful but functional code, I would be like, praise the Lord, this code is here. I'm so happy.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think especially with this code, I mean, it's not universal, right? I did a web design class here for my studies. And I think a lot of the students just built their websites from just random code they found on the internet. Mm-hmm. Because, like, it's already been figured out. You don't need to really reinvent the wheel. But, I get what you're saying. But do you maybe have other examples of failing in your career, let's say, or personal life, or... Mm-hmm.
I think recently I tried to run some analyses and I got some results that I thought, oh yeah, that's quite interesting. What's going on here. And then I discussed them with one of my supervisors, and he mentioned, oh, I read this paper recently about like the amount of data that you need in order to conduct this analysis.
Okay.
And I read the paper and I didn't have enough data. And basically my results were, well, a step in a direction.
Okay, but they're not conclusive.
No, not at all.
But could you not go back and, I don't know, did you interview people or could you not just collect more data?
Yeah, I can still collect more data later. But I felt that also did kind of feel like a failure, because I was like, oh, I did my little analysis and it, feel good.
Were you
about
proud of it?
It?
Yeah, you felt good about it? Okay.
Yeah. And I felt mostly that it was a failure because I just hadn't read that paper that very clearly gave guidelines about the amount of data you needed. And it's a paper that I probably could have read it and I could have found it, but I didn't. So, yeah.
No, I think a lot of students can relate to this. I think of... Well, I'm also writing a paper right now. Fortunately, my research method doesn't really have clear guidelines about how much. It's one of these, like, cause it's kind of, you can't really make a conclusion because it's qualitative, so you can't even generalize anything. So it's kind of like, as long as there's enough to work towards some sort of an answer, towards making a step in that direction. As you said, that's good enough. But I guess that's not always good enough.
No, and it actually did make me reconsider some of my future analyses. So in that sense, it is kind of failing up a little bit, because I was kind of disappointed with how it went, because I was looking into whether two sounds had merged that used to be like, they used to be different sounds both in Dutch and in Gronings, and in Dutch they have completely merged into one sound.
What sounds were those?
Yeah, so I personally cannot make them because they have merged for me. But it's the O sound in the words for hok and bok.
Okay.
For me, that's the same sound, but in Gronings they're different. And you also have some what we call minimal pairs. So those are words where that's the only sound that differs and it gives a different meaning.
Okay.
So for example, you have the word ball and bull. And those are, I'm doing it very strongly now, so maybe people hear the difference.
Hopefully,
Yeah. And one of them means bull, so like, yeah, like a male cow. And the other means a round shape, so like a ball. So you can kind of hear those in English as well, bull and ball. And in Gronings you'd have bull and ball.
So they are supposed to sound similar.
They're supposed to still sound different.
But sound different, but they sound similar is what I wanted to say.
Yeah, they sound...
They've kind of merged.
Yeah, in Dutch they have merged. In Gronings they allegedly haven't merged. But then my results showed that they did merge.
Okay.
And I found that very interesting, except then I didn't have enough data and I cannot really draw any conclusions about whether that happened. But it did make me reconsider, because I'm looking into so many different types of sounds and so many words. That I found, if I'm going to collect my actual in-person data, because this was more of like a pilot that we did online, but if I'm going to go to places and make recordings of people, I need to focus on way less words. So more sounds, more examples of the same sound, and not that many variables. So pick way fewer variables and collect way more data for those variables, because otherwise I'm going to run into this again and again and again.
Yeah, you really have to narrow it down, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear that all the time in academia.
Yeah,
like your question is too broad. You're, you know, this and that. You narrow it down. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's such a classic. Because I think I was intending on, researching like 12 different sound changes. And I'm going to have to bring it back to like... 3 or 4, maybe.
I mean, that's also more manageable, right? So you kind of ended up learning a lot, because it would kind of be a shame to spend so much resources on something that is... Well, I guess it's not worthless, right? Because you learned something, and then you also saw that maybe they did merge. You just don't have enough data.
Yeah.
You could, as you said, because you said you plan on collecting more data, right?
Yeah.
Maybe you were just lucky to find the people that say them... It sounds merged, right? Now you just have to find the other ones.
Yeah,
but it sounds that it was in the end a learning experience instead of like a complete failure, everything crashing down on top of you. Do you have other similar experiences? I remember we already spoke about that paper that you presented.
Yeah, so I think that felt very much like a big failure at the moment. So I...
Does it still feel like it, or...?
No. Okay. So I... Yeah, yay. I went to a conference and I presented some of the research I did for my master's thesis. And it was an experiment where I was really happy with how it went, and I thought I had some interesting results to share.
So again, it's kind of the same pattern, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I'm just too optimistic, you know. and it was kind of building on a theory of someone in the field who I quite admire. And he was also at the conference, and I had kind of hoped he would come to my talk. And he did, but then he did not like the paper at all. He was very critical of it.
Okay.
And mostly in a way that made me feel like, I didn't do the background research properly. I'm apparently not taking into consideration all the things that people have done before. Because the tone was very much like I was only... I don't know, kind of pretending to have done something new when what I did had actually already been done before, and I was just kind of ignoring that. So then during the, well, after the presentation, during the questions, I was kind of also blanking because I didn't know what to say. And I really felt like, oh, I messed something up big time here.
Yeah.
Also because it was, yeah, it was, he was like the big name in the field and there were many other people there. So it was quite embarrassing. But then afterwards, there were also quite a few people who came up to me and were like, that's not normal. He shouldn't have talked to you like that.
Okay.
So in that sense, it felt like a failure at the moment. But then afterwards, because a lot of other people were quite supportive and they were like, yeah, you know, he's a professor, you're a master's student, he shouldn't be, I don't know. Yeah,
that's critical of you maybe?
Or? Yeah, and also some of the critiques that I got at that time weren't really, when I think back on it, it wasn't very fair. It wasn't
really constructive. It was just, right?
I did take into account what had been done before, but I think he felt like I should have put more emphasis on that, on how the thing that I did that was kind of like an innovative part wasn't like standing on its own. I don't know. Could have done things different, but it wasn't as big of a failure as it felt.
Yeah, I see. So it wasn't exactly the same pattern, because this time you did all that research,
mm-hmm.
but he, I guess, just didn't like it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the same. Do you still use the theory by this person or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, okay. I think it's good stuff.
So I guess it wasn't. So I guess he failed. No, but yeah, from what I'm hearing is it really matters what perspective you take, right? Because there were these third persons in the audience who were also there and who also saw your paper,
mm-hmm.
Or your research and everything and your presentation. And then they also heard what the guy had to, or the person had to say about it. And then they said, okay, actually, that's completely wrong, right? Like maybe you could have done something different, but that it doesn't deserve,
yeah,
because it almost sounds like public shaming, right, in front of everybody, like the person who came up with the theory to just kind of shoot you down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that was the intention.
No, I'm not saying it was the intention, but that's what it kind of feels like, right? Yeah. Because there's different ways to give feedback and critique other people's work, and
yeah, definitely.
Some ways are just not acceptable, especially in front of a large audience, right?
Yeah, and especially if you're talking down, which was very much the case. Like, I was a master's student.
The person probably has decades of experience, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. He was a master's student. Was it a he or a she?
Yeah, it was a man. Yeah.
It was a man. Okay. It doesn't matter, but no. It's just to be correct. Yeah, but he or they had like decades of experience, and they were also master's students once. Mm-hmm. Maybe they made similar mistakes.
Yeah, and yeah, like you said, the environment does really matter. Like in this case also, because I did feel supported by other people who were there, who were like, yeah, okay, don't worry, it wasn't it wasn't awful. And with the thing I mentioned about the data as well, you could have had a situation where you do the analysis, you come up with your results, and then your supervisor sends you a paper and you're like, oh, I guess my results are useless now. And then I don't know, that could cause a problem or something where people are like, well, now you wasted this time or
money.
Right? Yeah.
If it's involved. Yeah.
Could be, yeah. But that wasn't the case at all, because my supervisors were also like, okay, well, now we know. And yeah, it gave sort of a new direction to my research as well, which my supervisors were also supportive of. So that's yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good for you. I mean, it could have gone wrong many times, but I guess the people around you really also had a very different perception maybe,
mm-hmm.
than you of what is considered failure and what is not, and maybe they just saw it as just a setback, right?
Yeah, even a step on the way, because yeah, you're never gonna do everything perfectly and arrive at your results without any reconsideration of what you're doing. And I guess these types of failures also help you, failures, I don't know, I guess that's what we're calling it now.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, it does help you kind of reframe your research or take a new direction or reconsider, maybe we should take more or less variables into account. So
yeah. I mean, yeah, you already kind of touched upon that, but I'm just curious, like, because those experiences well, from your words, sound like they were pretty big for you. And I can totally understand if you put so much work into something and then it turns out that it's not exactly what you thought it was. And, well, one of the cases is pretty horrible, in my opinion, right? I feel sorry for you.
Right? I'm okay.
Yeah, no, of course. But I just feel sorry because it's just not okay to do that. Mm. Especially for a master's student who's trying to, for example, push a boundary or something in research. But I was just wondering, out of all these experiences, what did you walk home with? Like, what are a few lessons that maybe you also apply to other things, right? Because we always try different things in our lives and we don't always do it. For example, sports, right? Mm-hmm. I think most students, I feel like, do some sort of sport. And in a lot of sports, you, let's say, weightlifting, you would think that you could lift something, but maybe today you just didn't sleep well, right? Mm-hmm. And you couldn't do it. So it's just a step on on the way to accomplishing something. So yeah, what did you walk home with from all these experiences?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess a general sense of these little things not being necessarily something big. Like, yeah, you have a, maybe you fuck up sometimes or you have like a small setback, but that's not necessarily reflective of like the whole process.
And of you, right?
Yeah, and yeah, especially of you. I guess also, maybe that's like a broader thing, but both also with the conference thing where you do something and someone else doesn't like that, then that's too bad, I guess.
Haters gonna hate. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, there's always gonna be somebody who doesn't exactly like it. But then we're going back to expectations, right? Different people have like your expectations for that study probably were different than that scholar's expectations, or maybe even some people from the audience. Maybe there were people that thought it would be worse than it actually was, and there were people that thought it would be better than it was, and there were people that kind of struck a middle ground and said, okay, you know, or maybe there were people without expectations.
Yeah, and maybe now that you say this, I think also maybe what also made it feel like a failure was that I wasn't meeting my own expectations of how he would react, because I wanted him to come to my talk because I thought he would like it.
Okay. Oh, but that's totally normal, I think. Yeah,
but if my intention would have been to, I was building on his theories because I really think they are good.
Yeah, okay.
And I thought he would go oh, that's a nice elaboration on my theory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if my intention would have been to to agitate or to be like, oh, I'm gonna
destroy,
cause some controversy, oh, this part of the theory is not good enough, I made it better thing. And then if he would have reacted like this, maybe I would have felt like that was a success. But I mean, that was not my intention.
No, I see. Yeah.
But I think in general, I have come to accept more that, yeah, not everyone's gonna like what you do, or maybe if you do something and it's not like completely perfect, that's also fine. If it works, it works. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned in the beginning with the coding, I like doing things that I'm good at.
Yeah.
I don't like doing things that I'm not good at. And I also don't generally like it if I'm not instantly good at something, which is,
I mean,
it's not realistic.
Yeah.
Because you have to learn. And I think maybe also through the PhD, I have learned to, okay, I will never be the best coder, but I couldn't code at all before, and now I can do some things. So that's something that I learned from scratch, and that's really nice, actually, even though it's not, yeah.
No, yeah, I think there's a great sense of achievement when you enter a field that you have no knowledge in, and then you start slowly making progress, and then you look back and like, oh, 1 week ago I had to look up, for example, how to create a document in the coding environment, because I've done a little bit, and I think that matters, right? If it's an HTML or a CSS file and they have different structures and whatnot. But then, do you think that in order to not feel like you failed, you have to set realistic expectations, or maybe walk in without expectations whatsoever? Because I feel like from what we've discussed so far, I feel like expectations play a big part in how you feel about your work and maybe a setback that you come across in your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the expectations are really important. And also to sort of check back in with yourself and kind of level, because I feel like I'm bad at coding because I'm in an environment where everyone's good at coding.
Okay.
Because I'm in the computational department I'm not a computational linguist.
Okay.
So I guess then I kind of set the expectation for myself because around me I see that everyone's good at it and, mm-hmm. you know, it just comes with the job.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, to take a step back and be like, well, before I couldn't do anything in terms of coding and now I can do something. So that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. One last question that I have for you based on everything that we just spoke about, what advice would you give to people, to students, to anybody, with regard to the fear of failure and how to deal with failure itself?
Yeah, I think so based on my own experience, because the things that I mentioned where I felt like I failed were usually also kind of the time to take a bit of a step back and reflect a bit. And not in the sense that, oh, let's linger on these failures and think about them a lot, because that's probably also not healthy. But I feel like sometimes they can be a moment where maybe you want to take a different direction or reframe something that you've done or consider like a different perspective and kind of use those moments to kind of, further what you're doing.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not as much a step back as more of a little sidetrack. And then maybe from that sidetrack, you decide to go somewhere else, or maybe you go back on the main track.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess use it as a little moment of consideration of mm-hmm. what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great piece of advice. Wasn't there one quote that was take a step back to make a leap forward or something like that?
Not sure. Could be.
Could be, yeah. No, but I think that's great advice. Well, thanks a lot for coming in. I hope people found something that they were that inspired them or that they could relate to.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Epic Fail, a podcast of the Faculty of Arts of the University of Groningen. Epic Fail is produced by Nina Jakimova-Stelma and Marjolein Tevinko. Music by Arnold Bodden. I'm your host, Julian Karachov. Tune in for the next episode where we talk to Hans Janssen, student advisor and lecturer in English.